Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Thanks a lot to the folks at CloudFlight for sponsoring my podcast. They are successfully helping an industry facing digitalization pressure to identify and solve their AI use cases. Today, their COO, Jörn, is my guest to have a two-minute chat about the topic. Hi, Jörn. Great to have you on the show. Let's talk about AI. It's a very hot topic for a while, and we want to talk about the importance of AI. So what is the importance of AI at CloudFlight?
Yeah, hi, Tobias. Thanks for having me. I would say the industry is facing a lot of digitization pressures. And at the same time, AI is almost omnipresent in private life. This leads to many people talking about AI. And this is precisely where the problem lies. Most of the people talk about the technology behind AI. But at CloudFlight, it's not the technology. That is the key to success. But understanding the needs of business and their users.
What do you mean by needs, and what are the implications?
I would say the challenges differ almost with the companies. The same is true for the associated processes. Nevertheless, people often try to map individual needs with standard software. And we consider that to be difficult. In the specific case of AI, there's also the fact that people often try to create a use case come hell or high water. The technology Zeus becomes on and in it itself.
I understand. What do you as CloudFlight think is the right approach to use AI successfully?
First, use custom solutions. And second, before starting, you should, and this is even more important, take a close look at where potentials can be leveraged with AI. At CloudFlight, we do this with a structured approach and our AI patterns. The aim here is to quantify the added value of individual measures in an open-ended manner. Instead of looking at projects from a pure cost perspective, the focus is on the return on investment.
But why should corporate decision makers now also be concerned with AI?
Tobias, it's simple. To be able to run the business more successfully. AI can help innovating existing business models, increase competitiveness, and optimize production and business processes. And for sure, all beginnings aren't easy. But it's usually worthwhile to get started. And of course, we at CloudFly are happy to help.
That sounds great, because I know so many cases where, you think you have a case for AI and you start implementing something and you end up with a mess. And I think having a partner there really makes sense. So if you, my listeners, also think that this makes sense and want to get to know more about CloudFlight and their AI offering, just visit cloudflight.io/transformation to get to know more. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby, and today with me is Thanasis, and Thanasis is the VP of Engineering at Trade Republic. Trade Republic is a trading app for stock trading with like lots of gamification factors, as far as I know. And Thanasis, did I forget anything in the introduction? Maybe you want to say a few words.
Yes. So, hello everybody, my name is Thanasis. I'm the VP of Engineering for Trade Republic. I don't think we have gamification in the app. I'm surprised to hear, to be honest. We're a savings platform, right, not a trading platform. And we've actually taken many steps to avoid gamification over the next 2 years and what happened with GameStop, right, 2 years ago, a bit after I joined. Czech Republic.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, what I mean is that you make stock trading easy, right? You make it accessible for people, and that's like one very important factors. If you know, like the platforms, like 10 years ago, it was horrible, and now you actually have an app and you can buy stock in no time, right?
Yes. So the original proposition was called TapTapTrade, right? It was actually simplifying this process that people already knew. Right? People who were experiencing the stock market, they could now, with a few taps on the mobile phone, get the stock that they want, right? This, of course, evolved a lot. Now we're talking more about democratizing access to wealth, right? This means we're referring more to newbies to the financial markets, want to make it accessible to everybody. And of course, low cost and simplicity of use are important barriers to remove if you want to democratize access, right? But this TapTapTrade, which, as correctly you pointed out, was the initial phase of the company, quickly had to be taken care of because when someone is new at the markets, simplifying trading might actually bring it closer to gambling for them, right? So we try to guide these users towards the right savings behavior. And that's why we want to present ourselves as a savings platform, not just a trading platform.
Okay. So you're a bit different from eToro and other players in the market, I guess. Just to name a single one.
Yes. We don't see eToro. Yeah. You know what? We don't see those as competitors, right? I think our closest competitors are actually in the US. You think of like Charles Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard. So big companies that help people invest their 401k, their retirement funds, right? More than eToro or Robinhood or Upstart, but more social trading or gamifying the idea of trading.
Okay. And what is special about yourself, before we talk more about Trade Republic, is that you have like a data career and now you're VP engineering. And today, in the later discussion, I'd like to focus on data and how like a modern data stack is designed or should be designed. Maybe before we start there, you can tell me a bit more about your personal nerd journey. Like, how did you start it and when and why?
Yes.
And what fascinates you?
Yes. So I think I'm a bit older than you, Robin. It's my invited person in the podcast, right? I finished my PhD in machine learning back in 2009, right? So back then, we did not really separate data from engineering that much, right? There was one role that was called software engineer, and I just happened to have a specialization in machine learning. First job out of uni was a trading company. It was called Source Capital, and I spent 4 years there doing high-frequency trading. Right? So I would develop end-to-end systems that would go to the stock market and basically trade in order to make profit. That was my first time I dipped my fingers into financial data, right? My PhD was on audio and video back then. And from trading, I moved to Booking.com, which was the first tech company I worked. So at Booking.com, I did ranking and pricing. The vanilla model, if you think about it, right? You come to Booking.com, you put Paris, try to find out what are the best hotels for you in Paris. That was a lot of fun. I stayed there for 2 years, and then I moved to the US. For Uber, Airbnb, and Netflix, right? So big marquee names on the West Coast and some of the most successful startup stories in the US. I left California 2 years ago to move to Germany for Trade Republic. And I'm happy to dive into all of these details, but we spent a lot of time on the podcast on the past, and I think the future is more exciting than the past.
Okay. But what is fascinating, like reading your CV, is that you worked a lot in app businesses. And I think like your knowledge about product analytics and then like data science in particular, or like a deeper sense, is really, really interesting. So let's talk about today. Maybe like a few words about Trade Republic. Like, I think you have like 1.3 billion in funding. Is that correct?
That's the total amount of money we've raised. That's correct. $1.3 billion in funding over 4 funding rounds at the moment.
It's crazy. I mean, what do you do with all that money? Is that customer acquisition then mostly, or?
That's a good question. So firstly, we're a fully licensed bank, right? So a lot of this money is actually reserves and capital requirements we have to maintain. It's not like we can go and spend it all, right? Like the FTX story. The second thing is we have spent money expanding internationally, right? But the big part of the investment is actually on people, right? We try to attract top talent. We try to give them engaged. We've built a beautiful office in the middle of Berlin, right? Where we hope people can be excited to spend more time together after 2 years of working from home. So a lot of this investment goes back to people, and all the auxiliaries of being a bank, right? We have to apply for licenses. We have compliance and legal and all of these other requirements. We run audits, right? It's an expensive business running a bank.
Okay. I can imagine. But I assume that customer acquisition is also part of the, a piece of the cake. I imagine at least. But yeah.
Yes. And to be more precise, so in 2021, like most companies, we spend a lot of money in customer acquisition, right? It was a period of very cheap and available capital. The name of the game was land grab, right? Try to grow as fast as possible, get as many users as you can. So we also had high customer acquisition costs. In our line of business, we have Refer a Friend, which is actually a great viral mechanism. And we also offer people a free stock when they join the platform, right? So most of the spend is happening on incentives rather than traditional marketing channels. I would say this year, the tide has turned, right? Everybody's much more careful with the spend. Though we still offer some of these incentives to acquire new customers, our spend is much smaller. Last but not least, because we're part of the financial markets, we were very early noticing the change in this tide. So this year, for example, we raised an extension of the previous round, which was a protective mood, right? We didn't know when again we'll have the opportunity to raise money, so we prefer to have a big war chest. We're very well capitalized and we're ready for any recession coming ahead.
Yeah, let's hope that it will be less bumpy than everyone thinks right now, right?
I'm optimistic myself. US might not go to a recession at all, actually. I think they're, I just go buy it. For Europe, things are harder, right? But in Europe, recessions are usually mellow and long, right? It's not like this collapse that happens in the United States. So I think we can weather it pretty well.
So from your company to you, why did you get into data at all? Like what made you, what sparked your interest, in algo trading initially? And why did you get into that?
Yeah. So, my bachelor's was in computer science, right? I had the feeling, and maybe I was proven more right than wrong, that as a software engineer, you continuously change technologies, right? So back then I was doing C and C++ in my bachelor's. Very few people use it now, right? Technologies change, languages change. And I had the feeling that when you move more towards to data, statistics, mathematics, you have kind of a more long-term set of tools that you can use, right? So that was my first step going towards data. The second step, of course, was chance, right? Most of us, when we make choices at the age of like 20, 22, 25, we don't know everything. And based on a few observations, we try to make the best inference we can, right? In my case, my bachelor thesis was on energy consumption on the ARM processor, this old Ericsson phone with a little door, if you remember what I'm talking about. And then the idea was, how can we help software in a mobile phone to get better in order to have less energy consumption and longer battery life, right? And the only idea to improve software was some type of artificial intelligence. We used genetic programming back then, and so quickly I saw a family of algorithms that I believe they would have this long-term effect, right? So they can exist for a while, much more, they're less transient than a programming language. That was the first decision to go more into data and eventually machine learning.
And then from algo trading to booking is kind of also a crazy move, but
Yes, that's actually the least crazy move, right? When you leave a trading company, you have a non-compete. So you can't go to another trading company. So I thought, you know what, I'll go to booking.com and spend a couple of years, take it easy, you know, not as hard as high frequency trading, then go back in the pit. But I think once you taste the life of a startup and a technology company, it's hard to go back to traditional finance.
I can imagine, yeah.
And also selling a vacation is good karma, much better karma, you know, than trading.
And now you have both under one umbrella and you're a fully licensed bank and so on. Do you every once in a while still write trading algorithms secretly, or?
So to be honest, I have taken a look at our crypto data. I think that's where most opportunities appear, because equities are pretty efficient as markets by now. It's hard to make money like with a quick algo. And I think crypto is much easier. But yeah, I've taken a couple of stabs at it, yes.
Okay. And I think all the platforms, that's also because of markets being efficient, platforms that existed to actually do backtesting and have easy accessibility to the markets, they disappeared, right? Because it was so hard to write an algo, or?
Well, I think for a few years, the market was moving up and to the right. So the dominant strategy was just buy and hold. Doesn't need a lot of simulation. And I think another reason is it's not just that the markets are harder to get to, but actually the speed game really matters. Right? So if you think about equities now, people have moved into wireless communication and microwaves and all sorts of tricks to get like a few milliseconds faster. And you just cannot compete from your home with your home equipment anymore, these markets, right? So I think all of this trend eventually died out and it was never going to make it.
But buy and hold, I mean, yes, right now it looks maybe horrible if you had like a buy and hold portfolio and you started, 2 years ago. But in long term, it would still work, right? So,
so yes, yes and no, right? Buy and hold, it's a risky strategy. What we recommend, what actually always works, is continuously save, right? So if you do buy the same amount of, let's say, S&P, MSCI World, these big ETFs on a monthly basis, in 10 years, you're going to be golden. And of course, there will be variance in volatility. There will be bad months and good months. But, you know, in the bad years, you get more of your index, right? Because the prices are lower. In the good years, you get less and you're more profitable. So the idea is this continuous investment, right? Once off, you might be buying in an unlucky moment, right? This continuity that actually pays off in the long term.
But that theory, from my perspective, I mean, I also like partly trade every once in a while. It only works at the very beginning, right? I mean, because the more you have, the less you'll add if you buy additional stocks. So you must have like a logarithmic function on investing more and more and more and more, so that it's
continues making sense, right? It works more in the beginning. So time in the market is more important than timing the market, right? So of course, if you're going to invest money now that you will need at the end of the year or in March, this is very risky. But if you invest money now, you're going to need them in 2030. Don't worry about it, right? And I think this is the idea. Timing the market is more important than timing the market. So these short-term investments are always carrying a lot of risk. We think about people who want to retire, right? And they're going to be putting money in for 35 years. And then I don't think there is any specific point that to start or stop. Just keep doing it and trust in the system.
Yeah, that makes sense. But we're not a trading podcast. I mean, I could talk about trading for a while as well, because it's a hobby. But tech. I'd like to understand a bit more, like, what really is your secret sauce as Trade Republic? I mean, you're a fully licensed bank and so on, and you have many competitors. What would you say makes your product very special?
Yeah, so I think we have the advantages of a fully licensed bank, meaning we have very low costs of execution, right? We're pretty efficient and so on and so forth, while still having the advantage of a startup, right? We move fast. We have an app that looks like it's 2022, not like 1990 or something, right? And I think combining these two is increasingly difficult, and it's increasingly difficult at scale. There is a lot of banks out there with longer history than us and bigger balance sheets, right? Deutsche Bank, but they can't build an app. There is a lot of other apps that offer you access to the market one way or the other, or to derivatives usually, not in the market. And the other have very high costs. Eventually, they're unsustainable, right? Or they are not regulated, right? And of course, it's hard to put your life savings in an unregulated platform. I think we combine the best of both worlds, and this is not easy. We can talk about it if you're curious, but I think this is our competitive advantage.
Okay. So, and from like looking at your tech stack and your product in particular, like what is the fact you're most proud of?
It will sound easy, but we recently launched fractional trading, right? So we allow somebody to buy, let's say, 50 euros of Berkshire Hathaway, right? So you can buy any amount of money you want from any stock that you want. There are stocks out there that might cost hundreds, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of euros that were inaccessible to the public before, but now I can actually buy a very small percentage, let's say 50 bucks or 100 bucks of this stock, be equal shareholder, right? So get dividends, get all the financial benefit, and hold just a little piece of this stock. So bringing this out to life, I think, is a big step towards democratizing access to the markets. It's a big step towards making markets accessible to countries with low income, right, where people do not have hundreds of euros to save every month. And it's also a difficult technological challenge, right? Implementing this correctly, not losing count, not losing money in the process, and pushing through all the legal and compliance hurdles to make this done. It was not simple, and I'm very proud that the team pulled it through.
Okay, so is it then like buying real stock in the background, like even if it's...
We buy the whole stock ourselves and give you little pieces, you know?
Really?
Yeah, exactly. It's the actual real stock in the back.
Okay, and if someone else comes and buys the other half, then wow.
You have half each. Yes, correct.
Well, that means that you need a lot of money, obviously. At least.
I can tell you, it costed us 2 million euros, right? So if you want to buy one stock of every stock, actually it costs 2 million euros. A few of them are very, very expensive, right? And of course, for some penny stocks, people don't need to do fractional. If a stock costs 3 cents, you buy a lot of them, you don't buy half of them, right? But it was not like a crazy amount of money. It was an investment worth making, right? It actually enabled a lot of people, especially in Southern Europe, to trade stocks that before were inaccessible to them.
So what was the first thing you did when you entered the company?
Well, more than 2 years ago, right? The first thing I did is join a meeting of my team back then, Data. I try to be a fly on the wall, right? Try to say nothing, hear, learn, right? See how the team is working, how the team is making decisions, right? And I can tell you I was very, very surprised.
Positively surprised or?
No, it's not positive or negative. It's just surprised, differently surprised. Right? In the past, I have worked in the Netherlands, in UK, in Switzerland, and in the US, right? And when I was coming to Germany, I had this expectation that it would be like Holland. But actually, it's very different to Holland, right? I came in, there was a conversation around how to structure tables for users and for acquisition. And I think the direction the team was going was a direction that many people start with, but it's not the right long-term scalable solution, right? Of course, as a leader, as a manager, you should not be solving problems for people. We should be teaching people how to solve problems so in the future they can solve them themselves, right? So I tried to intervene in the conversation and I asked, like, have you thought about XYZ, which is actually the right solution, right? And the response was, no, we haven't thought about it. And they continued speaking out the idea they had. So not thinking about an alternative was actually a fine part of the situation. And then I said, maybe we can think about this alternative. And they told me, look, you're the manager here. If you want to do it that way, just tell us. So people were not used to having this conversation. They were used to having this top-down decision-making where me as a manager, I pick a solution and they go out there and implement it. Right? And getting the team out of this mindset, out of the mindset that our manager knows better, because normally they don't, right? Out of the mindset that we execute and the manager decides, it took me months, actually, of work, right, to explain to them that whatever you end up implementing is your choice. You build it and you own it. And if it breaks, you have to fix it. And if it doesn't work, you have to rebuild it, right? And giving the final ownership of the projects to the leaves of this tree, that's a company, takes a lot of time and changes the mindset of people at the leaves a lot. I've used allegories, examples, stories, right? take a lot of time to get them to understand that they decide. I'm just giving ideas. They can pick anything they want. And at the end of the day, they own it. Success or failure lives with them.
And back then, you started in the data team. Was it problematic in the whole company, or would you say it's particularly a German thing?
In the inference world, there is a phenomenon called confounding, right? So when many things happen at the same time, it's difficult to figure out which of the factors affect the outcome. So it's the first time I was in Trade Republic. It was the first time I was in the data team of Trade Republic. It was the first time I was working in Germany. So it was very hard to figure out what is the factor that affects it the most. Definitely all of them contribute, right? So I have hired people from other German companies who came with the same mindset, expected me or their manager to decide about the solution. So I think it's a cultural thing, right? But I would say in Trade Republic, being a bank, we were particularly susceptible to it because we do have some authorities we cannot go against. If compliance says something, if BaFin says something, if legal has an opinion, this is not Uber where we're okay with breaking the law, right? We're a bank. We have to comply. We have to listen to people. We have to do as they tell us. And it's very hard to shift your mindset to the technology part of the company where, you know, bottoms up usually works better than top down, right? Where people are empowered to make decisions. So I would say a lot of factors contributed, definitely cultural, definitely the fact that we were a bank and we are a bank, right? But also I think a little bit the way things were traditionally done, right? In a small startup, and when I came, the whole tech organization was less than 50 people. You are still founder-led. Like the founders have a vision and you implement it, right? And growing into founder-inspired, where still Christian, Thomas, Marco have a vision and we just get inspired by it, implement the best we can, it's a slow process.
But you managed to turn the engineering organization around then fully, or?
Yeah, so it took some time, I would say. I can tell you, I think one of the breaking moment was, so a few months in, things were working already much better, and we had a big project which was to redesign our data warehouse. And when this project started, I would already have much more scope, right? So I would not be closely involved. I would just see people's communication in public channels. And I would notice that there was lack of ownership and really poor communication across different people. And what happens in these cases is when people expect, Tobias, you do this, and then I do that. And then I don't know. Mary comes and do something else. When people see the work as a factory line, where things come through the line and you put the bolts, I put the tires, and the car is ready. Right? When you start a project in technology, you don't know how this line looks like. Right? You have to figure it out. People have to get out of their comfort zone, find overlaps, communicate, and all the process end to end. And I could feel the project is going to fail just from the communication in these channels, just from what the way people would be speaking to each other. I did call an all-hands meeting, like emergency meeting. I saw them some things from Slack I've seen. I said, this project will fail. I don't even know what's happening. And that's how this message should look like. I think this is when I really broke through to people that what I'm trying to explain to them is not something that happens when I'm in the room and everyone is empowered, but that should happen when in every project, right? In every single communication, in every single room, with me or without me in it. And this created a few, I would call them apostles, right? So some of the other people in the team that were, they would be in the room, they would say, hey, this is not how we work here. Hey, we should be communicating. We should all the decisions. We should not be avoiding ownership, right? And this is really when the team broke through and we had actually a very successful data warehouse migration, also something I'm proud about, in less than 3 months.
Okay.
This podcast is proudly presented by Bosch Legends Lab. The Bosch Legends Lab team has set itself the task of simplifying access to software, engineering, and IT talent via a new matchmaking platform. Project owners can always find the right support for their projects from a pool of 250,000 top freelancers and 15,000 highly specialized development companies. For you as potential customer, this means a huge selection of highly qualified experts that you can easily access. Fast and flexible project support, simple and secure contracting, plus you benefit from the know-how of the Bosch Group because Bosch colleagues know their way around complex technology projects. And of course, you get a personal contact person throughout the entire project duration. To get to know more, visit boschlegendslab.com.
Are you very data-driven as a company?
We are definitely data-informed, right? I wouldn't go as far as data-driven. And this is both because of the projects that we're building and also because we're a bit afraid of data-drivenness, right? What do I mean by this? A few of the projects that we're building actually were not allowed to give them to half of our users, right? If you create a financial product and I decide to A/B test it, right, the regulator will come and say, why do you discriminate against half the people who don't have access to this product? So it's harder to A/B test. Right? On the other hand, we have now A/B tests in everything that has to do with user experience, UI, interface, and so on and so forth. So we're getting better at it. What we're really good at, though, is to be data-informed. So we make sure we set KPIs, goals, metrics, know what we're optimizing for and try to solve problems and just create solutions, right? We have a problem and define it before we go out there and solve it.
Okay, okay. And what does that mean concretely if you look at your stack and your application? I mean, you're very app-driven, right? So most likely you measure user activity and you measure you do product analytics in the classical sense.
Yes, exactly. So
how does your stack look like?
Yes, so let's start at the bottom of the pyramid, right? The data pyramid at the bottom, it has data storage, model, and availability. You need to store your data, model it, make it available, right? So we store our data in S3. We have a data warehouse in Snowflake. We use dbt for modeling and Airflow for orchestrating, right? So this is our stack, storage, model, and availability. Above these, of course, we have metrics and access to data, right? We use Looker, which is a tool great for both Explorer and for visualization, right? We have dashboards, access, and metrics, and people can see how their work affects the main company metrics or the team's metrics, right? On top of this, we talk about experimentation excellence. Once people get used to metrics, they want to know, how can I make it better, right? And we have our in-house A/B testing solution that allows people to run experiments on mobile, backend, or web, right? So all of our interfaces, and gives them directly 70 metrics automatically estimate for our users. last but not least on top, we have what we call data products, right? So we use SageMaker to create machine learning models that power things like recommendations or our ARPU prediction or our targeting for marketing and so on and so forth.
Okay. that A/B testing layer is really like custom-made in-house.
Yes. Yes. So there is three ways to do A/B testing, right? One is you use some type of external tool, let's say Firebase. If you want to get metrics in the external tool, you have to send your metrics there, let's say user trades. This is a nightmare for a bank.
I can imagine.
You don't need to send your deposits and your trades to Google or Apple or anybody else, right? So this is out of the window. The next idea is either you get a tool that you can install on your own or premise, or you build your own. Building an A/B testing platform is not that complicated. People treat it as some kind of impossible tweak, but no, it's not actually. You have to have a service that randomizes assignment, right? So Tobias comes in and he controls treatment. Thanas comes in and he controls treatment, right? Then you have to have the right metrics engine to calculate results on these two groups or three groups or four groups, right? And so although our A/B test platform is basic, it allows people to start, stop experiments and get results. At least 90% of the way there.
But it is then like essentially an API, right? Which you can use to start experiments. Or can you like flexibly change the front end of the app for such experiments? Or how does it work?
Yes, yes. So it compromised from an SDK, right? So the API works great, but the problem is sometimes the A/B test is in a part of the app that's visited a lot. Then the API will be hit all the time, right? So you create an SDK that can do a bit of caching, right, locally, so the app doesn't get slow. So we have an SDK for web, for app, for backend. Then, of course, we have the service, which is exactly what you said, is this API. And then, of course, we have an internal tool, which is an internal website where people can look at results, start and stop experiment with buttons, right, in order to enable a product manager to start their own experiments or stop them, right? or someone who is not very technical. You don't have to reach out to engineering to start or stop the experiment. And most importantly, if we roll out an experiment that has a problem, it's very easy to roll back to give everybody the control experience and not expose our users to the problematic experience anymore.
I mean, I've seen like many companies pretending to do A/B testing, but not many of them like doing it efficiently. That's why I like the topic. Would you like, if you would start again, or if you would just have like a simple app which is not like trading, where data is not so important, what should you recommend to get started with? Like if you wanna do A/B testing.
So that's a good question. The problem is not the lack of data. The problem is the lack of users. So if you have very few users, it's very hard to see significance, right? It's very unlikely to... So I would not do A/B testing if I have less than 50,000 users. And I'm pragmatic. What I would be very good at, though, is tracking and logging, right? So I will know what are my users doing, what are they clicking, what is their path in the app, right? So I would not underinvest in tracking because my app is new, but I will not go out there and test because I will not get significance from a test, right? Now, when I come to having a user size that I believe I can get significance for, it's very important to choose the first couple of A/B tests and do something that's meaningful in order to get interesting results. Right? So imagine I have 100,000 users and would change the color of a button, which is the example most people bring. They are not going to get significance for it. They will run an A/B test. Results will be insignificant. The product manager or the founder is going to tell the data scientist, you know, you don't know what you're doing. We wasted our time.
Yeah.
So when they have a very big and important change, that's the best time to roll out your first A/B test. And the main thing you have to do is, what if this change goes wrong? What do we do then? Right? So let's roll it out to 10% of our users, 20% of our users. Let's see how they respond, if they like it, if the app is still working, if they're still buying stuff or trading or whatnot. And then if something goes wrong, let's be ready to pull back quickly. So this feature flag, right, is already an A/B test. I would then go take the data from the feature flag from this period that we all exposed the feature to 20% of the users, let's say for that week, and run an analysis. And this is a secret A/B test that people did without knowing, right? And if the feature is big enough, then we'll see a lot of results. We'll see some major results on our users have more sessions per day, as we expected. And also some unexpected results. Now people go to settings much more, try to switch it off, right? And that's, I think, how you integrate data into the organization's mindset, the decision-making, and make people excited about the idea of the A/B test. You never run the A/B test with the A/B test as the end goal. But as you do a stage rollout where you affect your users at stages, little by little makes sure you don't degrade their experience. You also get other useful measurements. And this is the idea behind A/B testing, right? Making you better one change at a time.
So let's say I'm a bootstrap founder. I built like my tiny little SaaS business here, which is B2B. So I have maybe like 1,000 clients. You would not recommend me A/B testing, obviously.
No. I can tell you, when I was at Airbnb, we had 1.7 million hosts. The hosts are very different, right? Some are professional hosts. They have thousands of accommodations. Some are mom and pops that put like their spare bedroom of their kid every weekend on the platform. It was very hard to get significance on any test on the host side with 1.7 million hosts, right? So a lot of things play a role, including how different your population people are, right? So I would say in a SaaS business, it's very hard to A/B test, and I wouldn't invest in it anytime soon.
And analytics? Let's say I just started. I have no clue. I have no cohorts. I have like zero information, but I have this web-based app. I have like stable customer IDs. So I could build cohorts. Like, what would you start with?
Yeah, so the first thing you need to make sure you're able to reproduce your customer journey. So if you can create these little pathways of the user came to the app, they clicked here, they did that, the XYZ, you're not in a very good shape. If at any point of time you lose track of users, so you don't know how from point A they end up in point B, you need to increase your logging detail. Right? So that's a simple rule of thumb. Now, when you look at analytics, there is two cohorts. One cohort is the people who are like using the app. The one cohort is the new users. And every time you make a change, you need to look at the effects of this change on how the existing users use the app and how the new users use the app. Now, what the best and most successful companies do is over-index on how the new users behave. Right? For example, in our case, if we make a difference and the existing people who trade in Trade Republic trade 1% less, but people who just signed up trade 10% more, the total trading volume will go down, right? Because there's many more existing users than new users. But maybe this new interface is more intuitive. That's why people who don't know how to trade can now finally trade, right? And it will take some time for the existing users to get accustomed to it. Of course, when they first see the interface, they now trade less. The right decision for the long term is to make it easier for new users, right? There is 8 billion people in the world and not even 1 billion on Trade Republic. So many more new users out there than already on the platform. So make it better for people out there, right? And I think this decision is very difficult. And obviously, the founders, the early employees are early users who are using the previous user experience, right? But every time you see a win for the new users, for the just acquired, for people who are new in the app, it's a big win. And you should not underestimate the value it brings into increasing your platform, word of mouth, and making it viral.
Okay, over-index new users. Understood. Like, do you have like two recommendations, like for like smaller companies, for smaller setups? I know it's bad to talk about. You're talking about logging, but I mean, how, right? Would you do raw logging, or what would you do?
Yes. So in the places I've been before Trade Republic, we did it in house. Like a place like Netflix, Airbnb, Uber, we did not use tools, right?
Yeah.
I think right now for logging, the two major solutions are mParticle and Segment, right? They allow real-time tracking. They integrate with a lot of visualization tools, so you can do a lot of product analytics out of the box, right? So I would recommend people to look at these two. Snowplow is an open-source solution, right? That comes with much less bells and whistles than of course, solutions that are, you pay for. They can start with anything they prefer and see where the world takes them.
Okay, yeah. I mean, Segment also has like a huge login, right? And not so much analytics itself, but more event tracking, right? And you then send the events somewhere else. Do you have like would you use like IPython notebooks from the start, or do you have like a good interface which is easy to use as well?
Yeah, so when it came to Trade Republic, we were using a thing that was called Metabase, which was open source and free and very few features, but pretty simple. And business users could actually navigate your data sets, right, and do some simple visualizations. We do use Looker now, but in between this part by Snowflake. Right? So data is generally an expensive business. It's hard to get it done cheaply. Right, but a lot of these tools, they save you headcount, right? For example, how did we do event logging in Airbnb? We had our own SDK, and we used Thrift to track the changes in our logging, and then Kafka in the backend, right? But if you want to build this,
you need
10, 12 people.
Yeah.
Right? So if you think Segment is expensive, hire 12 people and build it. It's not impossible. And of course, at the size, it's much better to build yourself, right? But even in our size today, with 220 people in our tech organization, we still use a lot of tools like this, right? We don't think it's worth spending 10 or 5% of our workforce reproducing a tool we can buy for like $50K a year.
Yeah, I mean, that's also how I think Segment's pricing model works, right? They take an account that you actually save people.
We don't use Segment, by the way.
I think you can't, right? Because it's like, as a bank?
Maybe they're not in EU right here, but I'm just bringing it up as the biggest client, the customer out there, right? So,
you worked for Netflix in the position before, right? And Netflix has like a relatively interesting approach on working culture and responsibility. Is that where you picked up the "you build it, you own it" thing, or was it before?
Yeah, so "you build it, you own it" exists all over Silicon Valley. Also, it is very hard translated to Europe. We can talk about it if you want. But freedom and responsibility, which is what you're referring to, comes from Netflix. And I push for as much freedom as possible, as long as people get the responsibility with it, right? For example, I'm trying to push for unlimited vacations. Hard to do in Europe, of course, but in Netflix, there is no limit. You can take as much holiday as you want, right? As long as you get the job there. So freedom and responsibility is one of the main mantras there.
And if you mess it up, you're fired, which is also not so easy in Europe.
Yes, right. So at Netflix, I would say the severance was always very generous. You'd get 4 months and the fifth month during COVID, right? And this was made to make it easier for people to make the decision to let someone go. So don't worry if they will land on their feet, right? But yes, Netflix had a famous culture for letting people go. I would say most people get fired within the first and the second year. And then if you make this bump, then you can stay forever. Then you're Netflix type of person.
How long did you stay there?
almost 3 years.
Okay. So you made it.
So I went over this bump. I went over this bump and it was very difficult, actually. So what happens, if you pass the interview process, you obviously have the skills to be successful, right? But once you've been there for a while, 9 to 12 months, people give you feedback, and it had a culture of both direct but also harsh feedback, right? And then you receive this feedback from multiple sources, and then you have to accept it as a gift. You have to accept it. And it doesn't matter if you agree with it or not, you still have to improve and implement it, right? I think this is the difficult part. A lot of people are already great, and they don't feel they need to improve. But in the Netflix culture, you have to continuously improve yourself, right? And that's where most people fail. They come there, they're good at their job, and they think that's good enough. Well, no, that's not good enough. You have to be better, right? And that's why I'm saying between the first and the second year, it's very likely for people to go.
Would you say in engineering, there is ever a good enough?
No, right? It's not a place to be complacent.
Yeah.
And that's why I think Netflix has an amazing engineering culture, although it's a media company, right? I mean, it's a studio now, but this culture helps its engineering a lot, and not as much as its content, right?
So, could you name 3 things that really boosted your productivity or your day-to-day in the last years? Like 3 things you can give as straight recommendations?
Yes. So, depends a lot on your role and your seniority.
CTO. CTO, 50 okay. People.
So the first thing you have to do is, I think, every quarter, what I do, I create a spreadsheet with 2 weeks of my calendar, and then I move the meetings around, right? So I decide who I spend time with bi-weekly, who I spend time with weekly, what time of the day this should be. And then I go and put it in my calendar, and people have to figure it out after this, right? So your calendar gets super fragmented. Things appear, disappear, change. You have to do this defragmentation on a quarterly basis, right? And this is not something you can outsource. You cannot get your PA to do it. You have to do it yourself. So every 3 months, look at your calendar, fix it. It's like moving houses also. If there is one meeting that you are not sure if you need, you don't need it. So keep what you need. That would be my first advice. The second advice, I think, is very useful for CTOs I've met in startups here in Berlin. You have to spend more time with your overperformers and less time with your underperformers. So what happens is people have this natural tendency. If I have four people in my team, two are doing great, one is doing poorly, one is doing so-so, right? They spend more time with the person doing poorly, trying to help them to improve. The uncomfortable truth is, this is the time most likely wasted. Right? If you think you somehow don't set up people for success, by all means, spend some time, set them up for success. But they have to learn to succeed themselves. You cannot make the success for them, right? So second advice is spend more time with your overperformance, less time with your underperformance. Move this balance a little bit. The third advice I would give to people is transparency. I think the last 6 months have been very hard for the ecosystem. There have been a lot of layoffs. We had one as well. And if you watch conversations on LinkedIn, right, employee reactions and sugarcoatings, people did not build up well towards this event, right? They did not make clear that this is a business. That's a business, the bottom line matters. And the best thing is to add value to the business, right? People did not create the expectations that we keep our most effective people, right? And then when reality hits you, and reality will hit you one way or the other, the train, people were surprised, people were shocked, and people were not shocked by the layoff, they were shocked that their expectations were not met. And this means the expectations were not real. Did they not know that the revenues were not going well? Did they not know that the company was burning money at an unprecedented pace, right? More transparency could help a lot about we're a business, we're here to win, we want effective people, we need to have revenue. If we're burning money, that's not okay, and so on and so forth, right? I would say this would be the three piece of advice I would give. Recalibrate your calendar every quarter, defragment it, I call it. More time with overperformance, less with underperformance, and transparency can go a long way.
Yeah, especially the first one I had to think about a lot in the recent months. I use a tool for a while called Reclaim AI, which is kind of helpful to organize your one-on-ones and look into each other's calendar automatically and defragment on a certain level, like as long as it knows how often you want to meet your directs and so on. But yeah, like just deciding on how much time can I spend with whom is very important, and to regularly do that again, right? That's good. Cool. And then I still have a little surprise for you. So I have to tell you that I hacked your app. So I downloaded the APK from the Android App Store, and I actually unpinned the certificate. So you use certificate pinning for security reasons. I saw your API and saw that you have like an undocumented feature in the API. And it's an Easter egg. It's called Time Machine. And it's actually a way to secretly make money for your company. So you can travel back in time and you can obviously, like in the stock market, if you can travel back in time, you can imagine the effect. And we don't use it for the stock market now, but we use it to actually travel back in time. And we travel back in time to the point when you started at Source Amsterdam as an algorithmic trader in 2009. And we can now watch yourself, like your younger self, for a while you were sitting in front of the computer, like figuring out your first trades. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Tanasis' ears. What would it be?
Good question. I think I would just say these two shall pass. You know this expression? Like when something is great, don't get too excited. These two shall pass. When something is horrible, don't let it put you down. These two shall pass. Because these two shall pass. Whatever comes ahead of you, these two shall pass, right? I'm an emotional person and goes up and downs and swings. And someone being there telling me, you know what? Start a career, crazy things will happen. whatever happens, these two shall pass. That's what I would need to hear.
Thanks a lot. Very helpful. Thanks a lot, Tonesis, for your time. Very valuable information. Like I like the product analytics part a lot, and the A/B testing. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the AlphaList podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. AlphaList is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphaList.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.